The Guardian.
Journalism on the net means a lot more than putting text articles online or even video and audio clips. There's the phenomenon of live blogging, adapted by The Guardian for everything from football matches to episodes of Big Brother. And there's Twitter, used by National Public Radio in the States to enhance their audience participation shows. These new tools are the subject of another session in our Future of Journalism series. On the panel are Andy Carvin of NPR, London-based blogger Dave Hill, Anna Pickard, who's mistress of The Guardian's live TV blogs, Rachel Stern, who's the founder of GrandReport.com, and The Guardian's online sports editor, Sean Ingle. The event is chaired by The Guardian's features editor, Catherine Viner.
Well, thank you for coming. I think we're slightly a victim of both hot weather, everyone's out at the pub, and the fact that we're live streaming this and podcasting it, which means that attendance is rather sparser than those promised. Ah, but maybe I'm mistaken. I'm not Janine Gibson, I'm Catherine Viner, the features editor. Janine's not been able to make it today. But I'm really glad to be chairing this event because I sat and I thought about it and thought about how much, without really noticing it, live blogging has become part of my life, not just my kind of work, but also just my life. So when Dave was blogging the mayoral elections, it was a Friday night, I was a train up north, and it wasn't exactly a close competition, but I was still really obsessed with it and always updating what he'd written and laughing at his tweets and all of this. I can't watch The Apprentice without watching Anna's blog afterwards. I don't do it at the time, interesting. Do it afterwards. Whenever I'm on holiday, my black goes with me and I watch the minute by minutes of the football. So I sort of realised that without noticing it, it's sort of become part of my life. And it's very interesting how easy it is to keep in touch with people. We've been reading your tweets, Andy, since you arrived in London. We know that you've been to the Tower of London, you've had a curry in Islington, you tracked down your Aussie cousin, and you found the hotel broadband painfully asynchronous.
Yes.
Which is welcome to London, really. Rachel, I've been looking at your live streaming as well. I'm very interested to see that you've recently done this event called The Future of Media, just like this one, only they had an all-male panel.
Yes.
So this is
interesting.
Yeah. It's a fantastic panel we've got for you here today. Andy Carvin is Senior Product Manager for Online Communities at National Public Radio, which I'm sure you'll know is the fantastic non-profit radio station in the States. He's the coordinator of NPR's social media strategy and has helped promote NPR programmes and learn how to use blogs, social networks and promote collaboration with the public. He's launched, he says here, more than 12 blogs. It has to be 13 or 14.
It's hard to count because some of our bloggers don't like to admit what they're doing is blogging, so they still see them as columns, they just haven't had comments now.
Yeah. Columns with comments. And he's done the project Get My Vote, which invites the public to upload political commentaries about what it would take for political candidates to get their vote. He's interested in the use of Twitter and mobcasting mobile phone podcasting for citizen journalism at the time of disasters. And he's developed new ways of using technology in disaster relief. He set up an emergency discussion forum after September 11th, obviously some time ago. He created an RSS aggregator following the Boxing Day tsunami. And he was also involved in the Katrina aftermath, which allowed people to post multimedia content related to Hurricane Katrina. And he writes about all these issues on his blog, which is called Waste of Bandwidth. And he was live tweeting Hillary's concession speech at the weekend.
Well, it should have been packing, actually.
Yeah, it did have that kind of speedy, slightly not concentrated.
Yeah. More terse than usual.
Yeah. And he's obviously been keeping us up to date with his movements since he arrived in London. Actually, Jeff told me that you were a champion Twitterer. And for ages, I thought, he's won the champion Twitterer competition until I realised I didn't find any.
I should put braces on my hand.
Rachel Stern is CEO of GrandReport.com, which is a news platform that helps people around the world participate in the media. Some people have called it the YouTube of news. And not long after university, rather than pursuing a traditional broadcasting career, she decided to set up her own global news network. And I think the first live stream event that was a big hit for Grand Report was the iPhone launch, where she was live for 6 hours and had a huge number of viewers, and it sort of brought great attention to the site. It's a platform dedicated to news and collaboration, and she thinks that anyone can do broadcast journalism. And it's also, it accepts submissions as text, image, or video. And she's also quite often scooping others on global news with stories from Zimbabwe and Afghanistan, but I hope she'll be telling us about that. And she's live streaming this, so we're all ask a question, you're on Grand Report. Dave Hill, over here, is a novelist, blogger, broadcaster, and he's written for The Guardian for many years. He's got not one, not two, but three blogs. Clapton Pond, which is about life in Hackney. Big Britain, which he pursues his interest in British politics, culture, and identity. And London, Mayor and More, in which he talks about developments in the capital with special reference to the 2008 mayoral election, which I mentioned before he blogged. Sean Ingle, on far left, is the sports editor of Guardian.co.uk, and he's written on a wide range of sport across the Guardian Observer papers as well as online. He's here today because of this Minute by Minutes and Over by Over reports, which sort of set the standard, really. The first one was Spain versus South Africa, the World Cup in 2002. And since then, we've done football, cricket, tennis, motor racing. I don't want to watch that one myself. Rugby. And you sort of revolutionised life at your desk when a game's going on. When you're at work, you can keep up to date with it. He claims he's the original live blog, and he's going to tell us why. And Anna Pickard on the right is a freelance writer and blogger. She's best known for her fantastic blogs of Big Brother and The Apprentice. She also did the mayoral elections with Dave, and she's had her own blog since 2001 called Little Red Boat. And her first live blog was the wedding of Charles and Camilla. Now, we're going to give our American guests a little bit longer to speak because they've come so far. Andy, I was going to ask you first to tell us a little bit about what you do.
Sure. Oh, well, I work for a company called National Public Radio. It's hard to find another entity that's truly analogous to us, though often in the States we'll say we're similar to the BBC, but that's not totally the case. NPR's been around since the early 1970s, and it was originally created as a national network to produce content for local, nonprofit, and educational radio stations around the country. And in the years since, it's evolved into a content producer that supplies a variety of programs to 400, 500, 600 stations around the country. But we don't own any of those stations. The way we operate is almost like a confederacy, where all of these stations are independently managed, operated, local nonprofits. But they pay fees to us in order for us to create the content, and we also serve as an advocacy organization to represent their interests as a whole. And we were one of the first broadcasting entities to really dive in headfirst with podcasting, starting in 2004. I think we have upwards of around 500 podcasts now. If you take a look at iTunes, it's quite likely you'll see a number of our podcasts rolling in and out of the top 10 list there. But beyond podcasting, we, like so many other media companies, have been struggling somewhat, trying to figure out exactly how we now not only survive but thrive in a digital media environment where anyone can become a podcaster, a broadcaster, a mobcaster, a webcaster, whatever casting you prefer to choose. And we've decided that the way to handle it is to dive into it head first. And so rather than resisting the urge to try to maintain control, as I always tell my colleagues, we lost control a long time ago, so let's make the most out of it. And so ever since I came on board at NPR about 20, 21 months ago, I've been helping lead the charge to help our programs explore how to use the internet and online communities as a way of improving their journalism. And this takes place in a variety of ways. For many of them, it's as simple as having a blog where they can have a conversation with the public. In other cases, we've started to do experiments with user-generated content. We already mentioned one project called Get My Vote, which is currently in beta form, so we're still working out some of the kinks of the system, but we're hoping to use it very actively during the general election. And the idea behind it is anyone can go to this site and upload audio, video, or text of themselves in which they they offer an open letter, if you will, to a political candidate or a political candidate to say what it's going to take for them to get their vote. And we've already had somewhere around 400 submissions so far, and I expect we'll get many more in the coming months as the election really revs up. And the way we've developed it is any station or any one of our programs is able to mine this content for commentaries on air. And so one of our more popular shows, Talk of the Nation, it's a daily talk show, recently brought on guests based on the commentaries they uploaded to the site. And meanwhile, local stations can use it for local use. So the station in San Diego last week, they're having a very contentious mayoral election right now. And so following the debate, they invited the public to upload commentaries about what it would take for each mayoral candidate to get their vote. And so even though it was designed for a national political discussion, it's being used for hyper-local political discussions as well. More recently, I've been doing a lot of experiments with Twitter and mobile video. With Twitter, it happened somewhat organically. We never had a Twitter strategy, per se. It was more along the lines, I'd been using Twitter in a personal capacity for a long time for my A Carbon account and was having a grand time just talking with people about politics. So I started encouraging several of our shows and bloggers to start using it. And it got to the point where one of our shows, a show called The Brian Park Project, now uses their Twitter community to develop shows and develop segments for shows. And so when they feel like they're at a loss of ideas for what to program for later that week, they throw it open to the Twitter community to get suggestions from the public to help develop stories. And on those occasions where a guest cancels and it's a live show, so they have to fill the slot very quickly, they'll often turn to Twitter to get emergency guests to figure out what they're going to do on it. We've also been using another Twitter account called NPR Politics, in which we are blogging the hell out of the primary process, which just wrapped up, thankfully, this past week. And so every Tuesday night, Tuesday is the typical day when the states hold their primaries or caucus elections. The results come in, and so we use Twitter as an ongoing conversation in which we start broadcasting the election results as the returns start coming in, but also asking people to report on any voting irregularities they've seen locally, or to get reports from them as they're seeing candidates speak, and have people do voting and debates and critiques of how the candidates are doing each night. And it's been quite fun so far, and I imagine we'll continue to do even more of this as the election revs up even more.
That's great. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks.
I should have said, everyone will be speaking for a short period and then we will obviously open it up to questions. So think about what they might be. Rachel.
So I'm Rachel Stern, and I come from a slightly different position, although I'm just as equally fascinated by all these new technologies as Andy is. I founded a citizen journalism website called groundreport.com almost 2 years ago, about a year and a half ago. And citizen journalism is a very contentious term right now, referring to the idea that everybody armed with the tools that we have, the incredible cell phones and camera phones, and the internet connectivity that we have is able to participate in the news conversation by being where mainstream media can't be immediately and by having the eyes and ears that are already plugged in all over the world. And there are a number of different efforts that focus on this, but Ground Report's focus is to bring that kind of on-the-ground reporting, but to do it in a trusted, more selected way. So we don't want to just be a huge content dump, but we want to have a layer of editorial oversight. And my path to starting Ground Report was completely by accident and not at all planned. I was interested in diplomacy, and I was reporting on the U.S. For the U.S. mission to the United Nations on the Security Council in New York City, where I'm from. And I noticed a lot of disparities between what was being on the news every night and what we were actually seeing in the Security Council every day. And I realized that a big part of why nations could act apathetic or self-interested in really important issues was because people weren't aware. And the one issue that drove this home for me was it was the thick of the Darfur conflict, and Kofi Annan actually came down and came into the room and reminded everyone that the goal of the UN is not to bring humanity up into heaven, but to keep it from descending into hell, and that's what it was doing. And he basically pleaded with everybody to do something, and there was absolutely no action on the Security Council. And it was a moment that haunted me a little bit, but I couldn't quite figure out how something like this could change. So after that, I worked at a company called LimeWire, which is a software company that allows people to share music and movies, and I thought it would be more creative. And it ended up being not quite as stimulating as the UN experience, but it gave me the tools to realize that you can start to change that first imbalance in information with the technology that's out there, and that's what all of this is about. So there are incredibly cheap tools that allow people to connect on a massive level across the internet, and that's what Ground Report tried to do. So we try to help people participate in the news in three ways. The first is that anyone can post a story from wherever they are, whether it's a text article, images they're uploading, or video. We're about to partner with YouTube also to do our video, our on-demand video. And we also have a Mogulist channel, which is a live broadcasting channel that allows us to report live from anywhere in the world. And I do have to make one correction, which is that we're not live streaming right now because we weren't able to get the connection. But normally we've done tons of events, including the Future of Media event last week. So the second way that the community interacts is that they decide what's on the front page by voting things positively. And the third way is that we have a business model built in that tries to reward people for their work. So unlike a lot of internet companies that rely on people to create all this wonderful, incredible content and don't give them anything for it, we have a revenue share that gives people a monthly payment via PayPal based on the traffic that's been going to their work. And that's Ground Report in a nutshell. Some of the more interesting things that we've enjoyed doing is behind-the-scenes content, behind-the-scenes coverage and reporting and things that you wouldn't see on the mainstream media. So we went to the Democratic delegates debate, one of the early ones, when it was still a very close race in Philadelphia, and we sort of pulled back the curtain on what goes on behind the scenes. And we saw big drug companies advertising in the press room, for instance, backstage at the delegation, and that was on Huffington Post, which is another great example of good blogging. A couple of other things that have been interesting for us is, indeed, we have been able to scoop world events, often just because the tools are there and the U.S. media and perhaps some of the Western media as a whole ignores some of these issues. So we knew about the government stockpiling rice in the Philippines, forcing the prices to go up much earlier. We get constant reports on Taliban activity in Pakistan that we don't see in the U.S. news. And when Myanmar's when there was the huge coup, we were able to get photos from some of the people who were there. They emailed it to us. They couldn't access the site on the web, but they would email it to us directly, and we were able to put it on the site. And those technologies that go beyond just the browser, technologies that are based on mobile devices, is what's really interesting to us now, because especially in those regimes where it's harder to have the access to that technology and that kind of internet access to those sites that would allow you to use those tools, they make it harder to do citizen journalism. But with mobile phones and email and reducing it to simpler, more manageable tasks, you can really create big reporting efforts. And our next big goal is to build a team in Beijing, actually, of citizen journalists armed with camera phones who will give us our own Ground Report coverage of what's going on in the Olympics in Beijing.
Great. Thank you. Dave, would you like to be next?
Yes, it's been fascinating listening to you two people because you clearly know what you're talking about. And I'm going to change the mood slightly by being the person who doesn't really know what he's talking about, or at least what he's doing. I understand absolutely nothing about these technologies, although I seem to have ended up using some of them in the last couple of months. The only bits of live blogging I've done, the only real proper bit of live blogging I've done was during the London election campaign, where I went to an event at KPMG's great glass glamour building, and I was asked by the politics site if I would live blog this debate between Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson and Brian Paddick and Sean Berry, and I said, well, yeah, what have I got to do? And they said, well, it's really easy. It was in the evening. They rang me at lunchtime. I said, it's really easy. I said, oh, fine, okay. So I went into the office, and they provided me with a laptop and this phone and a thing called Bluetooth, which I'd heard about but had no idea what it was. And I was also told that there was a Wi-Fi connection in this building, but it was slightly unreliable. So I just about knew what a Wi-Fi connection was, so I toddled along, and I took the laptop, and I found a seat, and I sat down. And the Wi-Fi seemed to be working. These lights were flashing. I assume that meant things were working. I made a number of panic-stricken phone calls to the office saying, can you hear me? Is anybody there? This kind of ridiculous thing. And then just started doing it. About six times during the hour and a half that followed, the Wi-Fi packed up on me, which I was, you know, barely aware of at the time. I found it extraordinarily nerve-wracking because I'm a tremendously fussy person. I mess about with my copy before I file it. I'm always rewriting things, whereas this is the complete opposite. It's going straight onto the page. It's going straight onto the front page of the site. It was completely terrifying, and I've been unable to read it afterwards. I thought it's impossible that anybody would have found this coherent or interesting or accurate or anything. There'd be all these people finding me out, saying, you know, no, that can't be true, and what have you. But then after having done that, I started to pay more attention to the people who know actually what they're doing and are good at it, and saw, when it's done well, why it can be so fascinating. The next couple of times, that the nearest thing I've done to proper live blogging after that was on the day of the count of the elections, where I did an hourly update for Commenters Free, starting at Alexandra Palace, where some of the votes were being counted, and then getting the bus, a couple of buses, down to City Hall, and going up to the ninth floor and plugging in, and then carrying on there as the results came in. And at the same time, Twittering, which was a thing, again, I'd vaguely heard about and had no idea what it was, and somebody told me what to do the afternoon before the votes were counted. So I was... It was the most panic-stricken day I've ever spent, where I would be... spend half an hour trying to find out what was going on or something to write about, then write it, then file it, then Twitter something, then draw breath, and then start all over again. There was a wonderful occasion as the evening, as it got late and the light began to fade, and there was a sort of 20-minute period where I could rest, and I thought, I must try and look and see what Anna's doing, because Anna was live blogging on the politics site as I was putting these Twitters through to the politics site. And I read some of what Anna was writing, and I thought, this is fantastic. And oh no, she thinks I know what's going on. She's referring to things that I've written. She thinks I know what's going on, and she knows what's going on. And then there was this fantastic moment where I suddenly found myself reporting on what she was writing. Of course, everybody knew what she was writing anyway. That shows how completely confused I am about it. But I do think that it's beginning to become clear to me what the beauty of these forms of communication are, really. And they're the obvious things, the immediacy of it, just the way of sort of reporting, you know, by the seat of your pants, you know, making it up as you go along, which is a bit frightening, but if you can keep it, make it feel live, then it I can see why it's enjoyable to read. Brevity, it's a great lesson in brevity that there are actually... You can say an awful lot in one sentence, you know, and that you don't. Sometimes you only need one sentence, and that's quite a good lesson for a journalist, I think, apart from anything else. And there's the sort of mischief element, isn't there? Really, after the Twittering was over, and a number of people, to my astonishment, said that they'd been following the bits of nonsense I'd been putting up on the site and enjoying them. Things like, you know, have eaten one of Jackie Ashley's sandwiches. You know, this is the best I could come up with at the time. I was rather proud of that, but just little bits of information that came in, and people did seem to really enjoy it. But you can be sort of mischievous, and without sounding too pretentious, you can sort of slightly subvert what's going on in journalism, because of course, you know, in the old days we used to you know, read the great political commentators, my goodness, the gravitas, the wisdom, you know, and whereas this is a completely different thing. You might get things wrong all the time, and then you have to own up to getting things wrong. But I think that's all to the good, and that's part of the fun of it for me, is the sort of demystification of serious journalism, if you like.
Thanks, Dave. Anna?
Yeah. I'm just a bit in awe, because everyone else is, you know, following the democratic process and, you know, breaking news from Myanmar, and I'm watching what's going on telly and writing it down, which isn't really that hard. But it's kind of... So we've been doing live blogging of various television shows for the last few years, which is not all I do, but and it's based on the principle of our sport minute moments, which have always been extremely popular and that kind of thing, except just applying that to something fictional or something... a one-off thing or whatever. And also we have comments. I don't know, do you still don't, you don't have comments on minute by minute football?
No, we filter them.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is really the exciting bit for me is the idea of building a community around this ridiculous event of watching something on television and writing it down. And it started off as this, you know, a small group of people started to like what we were doing and would come along and say, oh, yeah, I saw that. And that's the thing, is it should stand alone as a review of a television piece so that people can come along afterwards and say, oh, I missed it, I need to catch up. Or people can watch it at the same time and actually add their comments in and we can have a kind of conversation. Because conversation is the best thing about the internet, I think. And we have built this community of people who do come along at the time while the show is on, and they sit in front of their laptops and they sit in front of their televisions and they do both at the same time, just like I'm doing. And they have great debates amongst themselves, and we run little competitions for which I have to still think of prizes for when The Apprentice ends on Wednesday night. But we kind of, it's introducing this idea of simultaneous multimedia, you know, kind of everyone is kind of taking everything in and splurging at the same time, except I have to do it in a way which hopefully doesn't need too much subbing afterwards because it's not going to get any. I don't know what to say, really. It's kind of different. I feel very humble in this company, but I think it's working what we're doing. People are enjoying and they're kind of coming back whatever we do, whether it's something as ridiculous as Big Brother or something as interesting as the mayoral debate.
Believe me, that was ridiculous too.
It was ridiculous sitting there for 12 hours, I have to tell you, and trying to follow what was going on television. This was the mayoral debates, because while Dave was wandering around the capital city, I was sitting in my front room in Brighton with no news coming in apart from, yes, Boris will probably be mayor. Yes, he will quite likely be mayor. Yep, he's still going to be mayor. Yep, we still think... And I was there for 12 hours kind of trying to find something different and interesting to say. And yet people were being drawn into that, and people were saying, you know, they were not only keeping up with Dave's commentary and my commentary, but when it drew later and later into the evening and they said, people started saying, oh, I want to go out to the pub. And so I left a comment saying, all right, well, if you email me your phone number, I'll text you when we know. And about a dozen people emailed their phone number to me. And I ended up there at midnight texting all these people slowly saying, Boris is the mayor, as expected. Love, Anna, brackets from The Guardian. And it is that kind of, if you're friendly to them, then they don't bite. And, yeah. And that's kind of what I... that's my kind of main experience of this kind of thing.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
How to follow that and our other guests. We started doing minute-by-minute reports long before I joined The Guardian in 2000. But in the 2002 World Cup, you might remember it was perfect for UK Times. There was matches at breakfast, matches at lunchtime, and people were at work and they were bored. And we had really high-page impressions, but it was generally just, as they'd been done before, someone watching the football and reporting on them. One day I had an eye infection, which was really quite painful, and I was typing away and I mentioned this. And strangely, about 10 minutes later, I had a trickle of emails from people saying, oh, you should try this. You should try, you know, bathing in your eye in salt water. And another one just said, you know, why don't you post your email address online? I've had to, you know, find your name through Google or whatever search engine was popular back then, you know, see your email address and post it. So I thought, oh, why not? I put my email address in the stand first. Suddenly, I was hit, you know, 10, 15 emails a minute, and it just exploded from there, really. And throughout that World Cup, we continued to put our email addresses on. In the course of a match, we were getting up to 700, 800 emails. Where we differ from Anna is that on Big Brother and Apprentice, they have an anything-goes policy. We have a policy where we try and select the best, quote-unquote, comment and put them in. And I found that all the people I've met over the years... I get introduced to people at parties and say, "You didn't put my comma up and from the ashes," and because there is that, you know, if you're getting, you know, I think people feel privileged to be on. And the truth is, if they post first thing on a Saturday morning, anything goes up. If they're posting when it's in a big Champions League final, it's quite hard for them. We've been on, you know, we've had some. What's been interesting, I think, as Anna says, it's helped us build our communities. We're on. We've been on. Sorry. Skip this bit on the video. We've been on the big online Slate magazine as praised our stuff last couple of days. Sports Illustrated has called our, you know, stuff brilliant. Even we had a spoof minute by minute when USA played Mexico in the 2002 World Cup, which Scott Murray imagined he was an American reporter. It was very, very silly and quirky. But it ended up going around the web virally. And Gary Lineker on Match of the Day that evening said, "Oh, this is what an American said about the match." And it was one of our minute-by-minutes, which is a bit strange. I think cricket's our most popular, cricket and football. We, you know, I think if you look at the hits over a given week, and we've done a big football match, a big cricket match, it will be more popular than anything else on the whole of Guardian.co.uk. They are that popular. And it's amazing how we're building communities through it. We've tried different sports from starting with cricket and football and going on to rugby and going on to some of the motor racing. We've started now doing horse racing with our brilliant racing desk. And I think slowly, again, we're building up a community where, you know, people are posting in requests and tips. And Tony Paley is here tonight. It comes back often with 11-1 winners, often with donkeys that finish nowhere. But they will ask him for advice. And Tony was live blogging himself from the Derby. So he was breathlessly dashing back, having spoken to Jim Bolger after New Approach One. And it adds so much more. Finally, what I'd say, I think a good live blog, it's a mixture. It's about being informative, about being quick. I think you want to get that basic information across, but you're also trying to entertain. And nowadays there are hundreds of live blogs out there. So what we try and do, two things different. You know, we try and be funny, we try and be quirky, we try and have good writing. But that reader interaction, I think, which is still quite rare, gives us something else. You know, it can be a bit like Test Match Special on the radio. I don't know whether people have heard that. You hopefully have good people talking, but you add some more, or like a really good pub chat with some really intelligent people wading in. And that's what we try and aim for. Of course, often it descends into a bit of a barroom brawl, but it works more often than it doesn't.
Why do people think that there is this sort of hunger for community now? I mean, you say that you put your email address on and with it immediately. It was like suddenly there was this community ready to join you. And, you know, why is it that this is... was it always there and it's just the internet's facilitated it, or are there other reasons?
Community's always been a part of the internet. You know, from the very first day the internet began in the late 1960s, all it took was one node connecting to the other, and after they got it testing right, they didn't have much else to talk about except say, "What are you guys doing later this weekend?" And it went from there. You know, the first email discussion list started popping up in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. Usenet discussion boards began around 1979, 1980. There were thriving online community networks in the U.S. starting in 84, 85. And so I don't see this as a new phenomenon. I think what's been going on in the last couple of years is the technology's gotten ridiculously simple for anyone to use, and so you don't have to go find a community. You now have the tools to create your own from scratch as well, and whether it's just an email discussion group using Yahoo Groups, or if you want to create a whole social network from scratch using a site like Ning, you can get that community going in a matter of moments. And also, the affordability of broadband in the last 5 years has just brought so many more people online eager to have that immediacy of conversation.
Mm-hmm. What happens?
No, I was going to say, I think people have an innate need to join in. I think in my case, it's like sitting on the sofa with your friends and having a good shout at whatever's happening on television, because everyone thinks they've got the funniest thing to say, and it's certainly not me. And, you know, everyone thinks they've got the tip-top comment, the best joke or whatever, you know, that they've noticed something that someone else hasn't. And not that it's kind of one-upmanship, but it is just kind of everyone wants to go, "Ooh, me." People want to join in. I think, like you say, the internet is about conversation. It's about community.
I think these are also things that already have communities that are built in, like sports. Before the internet, there were huge communities around sports and television. You know, people go to work, and that's what they're talking about at lunchtime. That's what they're talking about with their friends on the phone. And I think it's also an effect of just everyone is now using the internet so much, and it's just a natural extension of how we also build our own communities in this virtual space.
I think what's changed, though, is that journalists have decided to sort of get down and dirty with the public in a way that perhaps they didn't do so before. They regard themselves as up here in the public being this huge morass of people in the swamp. I think that we've come much closer together now.
That's the point I was trying to make at the end of my bit earlier, really, is that the whole blogging phenomenon, talking about comment is free, which isn't strictly the stuff that we're talking about here, but that the whole business of interacting with the people who come online, comment is free can be rather a barbarous environment, and quite a lot of those people should really be put away somewhere. But the point that you made, Anna, about if you're nice to them, they tend to leave you alone.
You have to be nice to them all the time, obviously.
No, but it is quite interesting how they do sometimes respond. Somebody comes on and is really, really very unpleasant about you, and if you can restrain the urge to strike back in similar terms and be patient with them, humour them, say, yes, I see the point you're making, but on the other hand, you know, be very reasonable with them, then they can be civilised, you know, and it's an extraordinary thing. And the you know, when I read the threads under the stuff you do for the TV program, it's just fantastic the kind of how civilized the conversations are, you know, and it is an amazing thing. There's just so many of those people out there, and that whole business of speculating about who the individuals behind these silly names are, and that to me as a reader, really, is as well as somebody who responds to these things, someone who writes this, is an enormous part of it. And I do like the way that it breaks down those barriers between, you know, the journalist and it's a bit risky. Sometimes they know more than you do. Try not to admit that, but they do.
It would all go wrong if The Apprentice ever did an episode on Israel-Palestine.
You
could be as friendly as you like. I mean, there is that thing. I mean, sometimes being friendly doesn't work, and sometimes... I mean, what happens if you don't like your community?
It's easy for me, because I don't probably, you know, not that it happens, but if you do get lots of abusive emails, you wouldn't necessarily... Barry Glendening, who's deputy sports editor and used to be a stand-up comedian, what he will do is, he finished second to Peter Kay in the Edinburgh competition a while ago. What he'll do is he'll put someone that's trying to be abusive to him, he'll put the comment up and then put a cutting comment back, like a slapping down the head.
But he controls it like an old-fashioned journalist.
Exactly. Yeah, well, maybe.
Maybe Twitter is a bit different from that, you know, because people, you tell me if this is wrong, but I've only been doing it for a while and I certainly don't update as many times as you do. We were talking earlier, it's astonishing time to do anything else. But I feel that everybody who I'm following and who's following me is sort of a bit of a pal, you know. Some of them I'm a bit worried about, you know, but generally speaking they're joining in because they're quite interested in what you're doing and they don't think you're really horrible or someone who deserves to be tormented. And I'm a complete beginner. I'm not quite sure what I should be doing with it next. There are these sort of 120-odd people following me around and seem to be interested in what I had for breakfast or whatever it was, you know. I'm not quite sure what to do with them, but I'm sure there must be something, you know, and I'd love to find out what it is.
It's strange because when I first started getting some of our shows and bloggers to use Twitter, they were very shy about it. They're much more comfortable talking on air than they are typing 140 characters. And after maybe a month or so of them posting very hesitatingly, they finally noticed that there were people replying to them. And occasionally they'd reply back. And then as the weeks went by, suddenly they found out that they weren't looking at Twitter as a micro-blogging tool, which is the way it's been advertised. It's not a micro-blogging tool. It's a conversation you keep in your pocket. And it's a community that you can rely on whenever you need to rely on it. And so in the case of the show The Bryant Park Project, I think it was very transformative for them. One of my colleagues described the community that came together on Twitter as a diner, essentially, like the quintessential American diner, where the very first time you show up, there are people minding their own business, they're reading their newspaper, they're sitting at the bar doing nothing, or at least it seems like they're doing nothing, and you don't feel like talking to any of them. But then maybe you come back the next day for breakfast, and then the day after that, and eventually you'll start having a conversation with the waitress, and she'll say something back to you. And then as it evolves, next thing you know, it actually becomes a family for you. And then if you don't show up, people get worried for you. And that's what I've seen happen on Twitter with some of the journalists at NPR who use it. And certainly I've seen it for when I use it personally, because you know, I've probably got 2,400 people following me right now. It is a little strange at times, but of those 2,300, there are probably 500 I know on, I was going to say a first name basis, but on a login name basis, where I feel like I really know what's going on in their lives, and they know what's going on in mine. And so when something happens that's important in one of our lives, we all respond appropriately. Yes. And when there are things to talk about, we use the medium in a way that ends up being helpful for the community.
Yes, and it does sort of take you to where they are. I mean, just one at random, somebody, there was a message from somebody saying, I've just told off 6 people on this train who are really annoying me. And I thought, God, I hope they don't retaliate. Is anything terrible going to happen? And sent him a message saying, are you okay? You know, and all this. So, which is sort of silly in a way, but I quite like it too. Another thing I'm finding is that, which might be quite useful in the longer term, is that you know many of the Twitterers have also got blogs, and I'm collecting the ones who live in London who collect blogs, because I think this might be of interest to the Guardian sometime in the future, you know, who are all these people who are actually old enough to be most of them's dad, at least, if not their granddad, I find. But they've all got these blogs and they're all their preoccupations, and they're living in New Cross or different parts of London. So it's a bit of a voyage of discovery, which I think is valuable, and we need to draw these people in to the operation in some way in the not too distant future.
I think probably another aspect is that the Twitter conversation or the Twitter structure is one-to-one. You're all on equal footing. Whereas when you have the blog, you're the only one who can post and reach all those people. They can only, their only power is in those comments. And it brought to mind this former blogger of a very popular American blog called, or very popular in New York, blog called Gawker.com. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with this. She recently did a big expose of her experience in the New York Times. And she talks about this like deep-seated anxiety about trying to, again, sort of please these nameless commentators who she had no idea who they were, but she had this real strong need to satisfy them. I mean, do you feel any of that anxiety? Or
I feel it on election nights, because I first started using Twitter to cover election primaries on a whim. It wasn't anything official. And after a few of these weeks passed by, and it didn't occur to me one night that there was a vote going on that night, I started getting lots of tweets back to me. Are you okay? What's going on? Why aren't you tweeting? And then I suddenly realized that probably an extra 1,000 or so people had started following me simply because they wanted me to be covering and commenting on the election. And so that's why I said before I'm so glad that the primary is over, because my fingers can take a rest. I don't have to take Tylenol and Advil on a daily basis for all the pain from typing so much. But it really got
Twitter a finger. It's
repetitive stress twitting syndrome or something like that. But it became an odd challenge. Because I never intended to be the unofficial political Twitter on Twitter, but that's kind of what happened.
But what about the emotional side of it? I mean, the Gawker and the Emily Gould piece was all about she felt sort of emotionally exposed, and she had a kind of breakdown because she felt that everyone, she was so public now.
That doesn't bother me at all, because I've had a personal web page or blog since 1994. And I've always, even though I'm 36, I'm sort of on the upper tail end of the generation that's much more comfortable about being transparent and open online. And I think that's the real shift that's taken place. It's not, at least within the journalist I interact with, it's not technology acceptance versus aversion. It's openness and transparency and being willing to be vulnerable to a public and those who want to keep things closed. And so when I see people who are journalists and embrace Twitter, the ones who tend to do a better job are the ones who are less self-conscious about themselves and more willing to just say things and live with the consequences and run with it.
Less private.
Less private, absolutely.
And less deference as well. That's the thing that, you know, you mustn't expect too much of that, which, again, I think is a good thing. It's true of all these things.
mean, obviously, with the big risk with sort of live stuff is, how do you get it right? How do you make it? How can you believe it? I mean, Rachel, I'm interested when, particularly in a journalistic sense, if you've got someone saying this is happening in Burma right now, how do you know that it's true?
Well, that's something that we have to work towards constantly, about establishing whether or not things are true. It turns out people very, very rarely make things up. What they do is they commit copyright infringement, and that's what our biggest problem is. That, and they post like poems or press release, and then it gets, and then you take it down, and they get offended. They said, "I worked hard on that," and you have to explain it's a news site. But the good thing about news, especially doing live broadcasting, is that people are a lot more forgiving. I mean, you think about C-SPAN; it's not cinematography. It's pretty straightforward. So thankfully, you have a little bit of leeway there, and that's also good, because a lot of the technologies, especially in the U.S., the cellular technologies and the networks are just not where they need to be in order to do that kind of live coverage. But on the other hand, there are tools that are really advanced and completely free. The Mogulus, the Ustream, all of these different platforms that allow you to do professional grade graphics and put the over the shoulder and the bug and cue in from multiple cameras. So you can get pretty close to the degree of something like an NBC. And I have presented Ground Report TV at NBC, and some people said they were a little bit scared about what a technology like this could do to their model.
Well, once the mobile networks catch up in the States, I think we're going to really see a groundswell of mobile reporting, especially as some of these Nokia phones become more common. It's unfortunate that I don't have a data plan while I'm here in the UK, because if I did, I could be streaming a live video of everything that's going on here, because there are now these free tools out there. One of them is called Quik, Quik.com, and you download a bit of software and put it on your phone, and then once it's ready to go, you just hit the record button and it starts streaming live onto your Quik webpage, and it'll also cross-post to Mogulus as well, so my Mogulus users can see it there, and it goes to a variety of other places. But what I find the most innovative thing about this streaming mobile video is that when people watch the video, there's a chat room next to it, and you can type in questions and comments. Not only do they have that discussion among themselves, it appears on your screen right here. So there have been times where I've been doing mobile video on here, walking around in the middle of nowhere, and then all of a sudden I'll get directives from people out in the audience saying, "Oh, you need to go over here. There's a really interesting thing to see over there." And so they're no longer acting as the audience. They're acting as my directors, actually, making sure that if I'm talking to someone, I ask the right questions or offering their own commentary. And so as long as the network doesn't crash, it's an amazing experience. But the network crashes all the time.
And it is strange. I had a similar experience, because I wanted to live stream on the Quik phone using the Nokia N95 my primary vote way back. And I was there. It was raining. I couldn't tell what was going on. And then I had a friend with me, and I said, "I can't tell if this is working." And then someone just typed in, "No, we can see you.
Right. Yeah.
You know, go ahead, go
vote."
Yeah,
you
all
kind of
it was so strange. It's almost a little bit intrusive. And I realize I'm sort of in a different category from everyone else at the table, because while we do post stories and I will occasionally do things on Ground Report, I'm not primarily a journalist or a blogger. I'm trying to give other people the ability, or I'm trying to, you know, sort of maybe out of my own apprehension about doing it myself, but I'm trying to just focus on other people doing that. And it is a vulnerable experience.
I've got a question, which is something sort of what I'm trying to envisage. It's very difficult for me to do, is to understand how these new things, this new stuff that we're talking about, and which I'm just about discovering for myself. How do we, you know, if you look at The Guardian as a whole, as an entity, in 6 months or a year's time or whatever, how do you incorporate this stuff and really make the full use of it? I mean, it's so obvious that, you know, the enthusiasm for the cricket and the football stuff, and the incredible response that Anna's coverage of the telly things is, there's a huge, huge audience of people out there who really, really want to be involved in it. And you sort of think, well, should we almost think, you know, we should be doing nothing except this, really. It's almost the most important thing to be doing, you know, in a funny way, just in terms of getting people interested and involved. So it's a very vague sort of question, but maybe some people in the audience have some interesting things to say on this. You know, how do you actually develop this and really make it pay for the Guardian, because which seems to be leading the way? Say something, somebody. I need answers.
That's the new role of of us, increasingly at The Guardian, we know these technologies are out there, and we have all that editorial expertise and experience, and it's our job to work out how to use them. I've got so many questions. Where do I start? I wanted to ask Anna, you just mentioned briefly that your blog posts aren't subbed, and if they were subbed, how would that change the tone and the voice of what you do?
Well, they couldn't be subbed while I'm doing it, because A, our technology doesn't make that possible, and B, there's just not time. It would be ridiculous. If I sometimes wish that someone would go, because I go in after things are finished and then spend another hour just kind of clearing up dreadful typos and apostrophes that make me shudder, but as well as responding to comments. I would hope, I mean, because the reason I do what I do is because I had my blog and that was the voice that people wanted, and so that's the voice that I'm using. And I hope that, you know, if the things do, because we, I mean, if we're going to do this kind of stuff more, then yes, people will want to see things being subbed and things being quality controlled in some way. And I don't know. I mean, I hope personally that wouldn't kind of take too much voice out of it, because that's pretty much all I have. So it kind of I don't know. I hope it wouldn't change that much.
I don't think subbing is about taking a voice out.
No, anyway. No, I don't think it is. But
and I think yeah.
Well, shouldn't
I think
be.
It would
shouldn't
no,
be.
It's almost part of the character that is perhaps a bit messy. Yeah,
but you'd just quite like somebody to correct that spelling mistake. You know.
Yeah, at NPR. At NPR, our policy is for regular blogs, if they're not doing live blogging, just regular blogging, you always have at least one other set of eyes take a look at it. Some blogs tend to have an editor who's a bit heavier than others, but the vast majority of them are just simply looking for grammatical mistakes and other errors. They don't want to touch the voice of the writer. On the occasions when people are live blogging, obviously it's not very easy to copy edit while you're doing that, and so typically while one person is live blogging, another producer or editor is simply observing and making edits as necessary, and they're not even talking to each other. But if it's something minor, they let it slide. And then Twitter's a whole other animal, because when you're stuck with 140 characters or less, it's pointless to actually say things with proper spelling and grammar. It's nice when you do, but it's not expected. And in fact, it's often expected that you are going to abbreviate things, sometimes using text messaging speak in the same way that you would if you were using your mobile. And so it's funny, because when I see some of my colleagues using Twitter for the first time, they quickly run out of space because they're using fully fledged English. And then after a few weeks, they're finally speaking like everyone else and abbreviating things left and right and getting the jargon correctly. But I think it really just depends on what the tool is and how important immediacy is.
I think, but we should point out that tonight is like a really big live blogging night because of the new iPhone coming out, and there are so many blogs that have really nailed live blogging for that. But not just The Guardian, probably a lot of other traditional news sites need to be so much more sophisticated. I know Engadget has like at least four people blogging, doing one blog post for the iPhone launches. You know, one person writing, one person checking other sites, one person proofreading, and another person running around doing all the photos and video and stuff.
Twitter has even shut down some of its features today because they're so worried they're going to have yet another crash. They want to maximize capacity for all the live tweeting people are going to be doing for the iPhone event. But I still crash though.
But I was sort of shocked by how often the Twitter mention came with every iPhone mention. It's like the Twitter convention has become such an integral part of the conversation that you can't acknowledge the topic without saying, "Oh, well, what if we're not able to talk about it?" It was in almost every tweet, because I was actually the best way that I find to understand Twitter, because we mostly use it as a way to disseminate our articles. So we do our RSS feed on Twitter. We're going to roll one out that will be sort of a story desk, a ground report story desk that we can use to really quickly access all of our reporters and tell them we need a story on this immediately. You know, please post. But Some Eyes has been something that I use all the time, and their coverage today of the launch is really great. And it's just a search. You put in any keyword you want, and it searches all the recent Twitter mentions, and it's incredible because you really see this live, dynamic conversation unfolding.
Yes, yeah, so there are some eyes, TweetScan, there are a few others as well, these search engines dedicated to Twitter. And it's been interesting because you can hack together Twitter accounts that do nothing but summarize what's going on in the rest of the Twitterverse based on what's pulling out of Twitter. So, for example, during... let me parse that out. During some of the election nights, like when we had the primary vote in Pennsylvania, I created a Twitter account called PA Votes. And what I did is the Twitter account would automatically retweet any mention across the Twitterverse that said the words Pennsylvania primary. Similarly, it would also retweet the tag, the word PA Votes when people put it in as a tag. And so that way you could subscribe just to that one account and get opinions and perspectives from dozens upon dozens of people who were talking about it that night, but you weren't necessarily subscribing to. And it's something we actually put into practice for the Bryant Park Project folks because so many people were discussing BPP on Twitter, we decided to create a Twitter account called BPP.diner that so every time someone mentioned BPP, it would appear there. So that way other users could subscribe to it and find other people on Twitter who were interested in the show and form friendships with each other.
Mm-hmm. And one last thing, which is that it sounds like this is almost what the future or the potential of RSS should have been, the ability to follow whatever topic you're interested in. Instead, it's so divisive, the RSS feed being the code that gives you just the headlines from whatever news source you like. But there, Twitter is going so far beyond that because you don't have to already subscribe because it finds the people who are continuing that conversation even if you don't know who they are.
Should we have some other questions?
Do you worry that with some of this technology, particularly Twitter, which is really, really unstable and really, really ephemeral, that you are building journalism on something that is almost a house of cards?
Ephemeral in the sense that it's crashing all the time,
Twitter ephemeral in the sense that once you write something, it's gone. So if I want to find out what Dave Hill wrote on the night of the mayoral election,
it's not necessarily gone. In the case of the Bryant Park Project, we extract the tweets that they send out and put it on their webpage. And so you can just go to their website and you can see what's going on there. And tools like SumEyes and TweetScan are now becoming archives and repositories for any, you know, you go in and you type in any keyword, and so you look up mayoral election London or something like that, you'll see thousands upon thousands of tweets that have built up over time on that particular topic. And so the experience of Twitter is very ephemeral, certainly, but once people have started creating tools that can tap into the RSS feeds and tap into the archives, suddenly you're able to start producing bodies of knowledge where you can actually follow a theme from the beginning to end. And it was a very smart move on Twitter's part to make their platform totally open so anyone with a bit of coding skills could go and create search engines and archiving tools and tag-making tools and others, because Twitter didn't do any of that. They don't have the capacity to do it, and so it's all volunteers who've decided to invest time in it that have created all this added value to the technology.
I mean, it's not the only thing you want, is my answer to your question. You know, you don't want just that. You do want the other stuff as well. But it's just, for me, it was just using it on that one day for the first time. It was just suddenly, it's an obvious thing, it's just another way of reporting, isn't it? It's just another way of coming up with something. And it's a different way, it's a sort of different way of seeing things. You know, the thing about these different media is that they do require slightly different things of you. You express yourself in a slightly different way. With greater brevity, economy, or whatever it is, or just to be humorous or whatever. It's just that, I mean, it just goes to show that there are an infinite number of ways of covering the same event, and even if you're one person can end up covering the same event in about three different ways, which is what I ended up doing with the elections. I was trying to write, you know, considered, thoughtful, you know, apparently serious, longer pieces, and I was trying to write blocks of interesting copy, and I was running around grabbing people to interview for the Comment is Free hourly things, and then, oh, I've got to Twitter something now, let's make fun of that fellow's tie, you know, or whatever it is, you know, or Brian Paddock has just walked in, ... or whatever you could come up with. I suppose you're trying to entertain people in a way.
Isn't the whole point about just, it that it is of the moment?
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of, I mean, and it can be useful journalistically for those reasons. I mean, there was that guy who claimed that that he saw news of the China earthquake on Twitter minutes before the American Geological Survey put it up.
Well, that's standard. Like, Twitter and earthquakes. Just do a search for those two terms, and you're going to find a gazillion stories. Yeah. And it wasn't the Chengdu earthquake was just the most recent version of that. When the earthquake happened here.
The huge one. Yeah,
the real big one you guys had. You know, I saw stuff on Twitter probably 30 or 40 minutes before the U.S. Geological Survey was mentioning it. We had a slight tremor outside of Washington D.C., which never gets tremors. I mean, I didn't know we had a fault line anywhere nearby, and it played out in a very interesting way because a number of people immediately posted messages that literally said, "What the hell was that?" And then a moment or two later, they typed again, "My house just shook, my flat just shook," or whatever. And so a conversation started among local people in Washington, D.C., trying to figure out what was going on. But then there's a guy on Twitter named Dave Weiner, who you may know. He's a fairly well-known technologist and blogger in the U.S. He basically is the guy who developed podcasting. And he was on a phone call with someone who was in Northern Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., who said that they had heard an explosion. And so he mentioned that on Twitter, and immediately his message started getting reposted everywhere, and people assumed that there had been a terrorist attack somewhere in the D.C. area. But as that conversation was playing out, the people who had sent tweets 20 or 30 minutes prior to Dave, who had experienced the shaking, said, "No, that wasn't an explosion. That felt like a tremor. That felt like an earthquake." And so what could have been a rumor that spread out of control, Twitter actually acted as a form of checks and balances to get the story correctly over time. And so by the time everyone figured out it was an earthquake, people on Twitter had already calmed down and said, okay, that probably was a tremor. It beat the local broadcasters who weren't sure what it was. It did beat the U.S. Geological Survey by about 90 minutes as well. And so it's every time there's an earthquake, there's going to be another Twitter story on the news about 24 hours later because they think it's suddenly a watershed moment for Twitter. But it happens every time.
I think, to carry on from Dave's point about what we were doing during the elections, is I think it can feed in different ways, and we can use it in different ways. Like, for example, one of my main jobs was to sit there and retype everything that Dave had said on Twitter into a blog post. And I can imagine, with the cheese sandwiches were brilliant, but if we had a few more people at different places in London, they'd all been kind of feeding into Twitter, and I'd been kind of aggregating that, as well as kind of saying, and meanwhile on the television they are reporting, then that not only archives it, but also brings it together for people who don't want to follow someone on Twitter. But I think there are lots of other interesting things we can be doing, like, you know, kind of setting up an account for the Hay Festival or whatever and saying, people, if you subscribe to this, then it'll let you know when events are starting, or to say, you know, kind of, oh, there's this really interesting thing going on over here right now. If you're in Hay, come over. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. Because if people are following Twitter on your mobile phone, which you can, then I think we can use it to kind of, you know, speak to our readers in a different way. And especially kind of based around singular events like this.
That's a very good thought. And with different sorts of events, like political events or something, you need to pick up on that thought. And you could have had, you know, a whole bunch of people twittering away from different bits of, which is a bit like what bloggers should have been doing. And I wish there'd been more people blogging about the London elections than actually did. Only a few people were really doing it well. But you could have had a whole load of people sending in little bits and pieces from different parts of the city, and you sort of pull it together, and it's a bit like a new version of what you used to call, or still do call, you know, reportage, where you've got, you know, people write the descriptive piece of rather than the hard news piece, they write the descriptive atmospheric piece. But instead of it being one person doing it later, you've got 100 people doing it now, you know, and it's all pulled together, and it's not, you know, it's not just the one voice. So you could have something that really, you know, to pick up your point about it being ephemeral, well, it's instantaneous, and in a sense it's ephemeral, but it is also, you could also go back to it if it could all be gathered together in one place, and that does document that day, that event, in a new way, which we haven't really been able to do before. And it's just so-called ordinary people doing it. It's not necessarily professionals doing it. So,
right.
Which brings to mind certainly...
Did I say something sensible?
Everything you
astounding.
Said is sensible. It brings to mind the sort of hope for citizen journalism, and that's why I love that you mentioned that someone is bringing it all together and synthesizing it in a comprehensive manner, because one of the biggest criticisms of citizen journalism is that you have all these people and they're just reporting on whatever. But I think that that piece is really necessary, is to have the editor in that role, but then at the same time to organize those hundreds or so people to bring in something that's of value. And I am interested if what is the attitude towards that kind of outreach? I mean, are all of the editors really this open to these technologies? Because it's groundbreaking stuff at The Guardian.
I don't think I know the answer to that question because I don't deal with very many of them. But certainly there are some. But, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, the transition is, you know, it's a big transition for some people.
And, I think, you know, people are very
It's
excited.
Bound to be, really. It's
sort of, yeah, I mean, you're very excited about the possibilities of it, but also very worried about what that will do to... You know what we do,
because
you know,
standards, you know,
and the,
really.
And the
aware, yeah.
you know the what I mentioned before about how we believe in it and how can we trust it, and that's you know, if you're a news organisation and you don't have trust, then you're in trouble. And what do we do with that? But I think there's a, I mean, you're probably aware that Guardian has sort of pushing in this thing direction many more than lots Absolutely. Of other mainstream news organisations. So, right, next question, Robert.
Hello, probably a question sort of about live blogging, really. Something's been going around in my brain is that if the text internet had been invented before the radio, isn't this how we would do a talk radio programme or a call-in type radio show? Mm-hmm. And I suppose my question is that in the next few years, I think it's inconceivable that The Guardian won't be doing something like live radio. And when that happens, will live blogging go away? Or is there something about this kind of medium that is unreproducible in radio?
Well, I think there is. I think if you're on a train or you're out and about, the number of times I'm on a Saturday afternoon, I'll click on live scores, I'll click on a live blog just to see what's going on. I think you can't get that from a radio. I think also, certainly with Anna and The Apprentice, you know, live radio, it's presenter one, you know, having a conversation with one other person probably. On The Apprentice, there's all sorts of people wading in. I think that's different as well. So I think this will be popular and in the future. Certainly, it's how we can tweak it and how we can change things to you know, incorporate all this new technology that's coming through, like Twitter. Like, you know, I mean, it'd be great in a football minute by minute if you could have. Some Twitter, you could have, you know, people sending you pictures on their mobiles from games. There might be rights issues there. But that's what I think we should be going down, not thinking that it'll come to an end.
Because these things are on anyway, aren't they? I mean, The Apprentice is on anyway. They can watch it if they want. Yeah. Or they can read it, or both. You know, and it's sort of... I know that Anna, sort of, we had that columnist writing about how, what a ridiculous thing to be blogging on something that's not even live.
Yes.
We all went, well, that's what's, you know, I mean, it just shows that even it's something that's not even live and yet still everyone wants to read about
well,
it.
Well, reading is partly it's reading, isn't it? I mean, it is nice to read something that somebody's written that's funny or insightful, and that is a different thing from listening, apart from anything else. I mean, that parallel between radio phone-ins and blogging has been made before, and you know that feeling, especially late at night, that people who phone-in programs are really quite dangerous and unpleasant, you know. And you know there's probably only three of them who actually rang in, and that's why they're on. It is a bit worrying, and you get a similar feeling like that with some of the people who come on comment threads on Commenters Free. But just that point about reading stuff, you know, it is a different thing from listening to things. So for that simple reason alone, I suppose it's distinctive.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's kind of like just like the sports ones. It should stand alone as a kind of review or catch up afterwards, which somehow radio wouldn't if you weren't watching it exactly the same time, you know. And also, I can't listen to two things at once. I don't. However, I am part of that. A certain sad clique or generation who sits in front of the television and can't just sit in front of the television. I just have my laptop open anyway. So I would be there anyway. So it's, and the people who are reading and kind of carrying on with these things, I imagine are doing the same. And while I'm following a live blog of something, I might also be following the football scores or something else and have 19 tabs open at once. And it's all about multitasking, and I can't listen to the radio and do that at the same time and watch television.
But the point Kath made earlier is that if we weren't following what you were writing when you were writing it, you look at it the next morning. So, yeah. That's good too.
And you're still part of the community if you do that. Mm. I mean, that, you know, you're still part. You don't have to be.
Yeah, you're just entertained and you found out what happened.
We often find that minute-by-minute reports the following day get at least as many hits as sometimes newspaper match reports, which is, again, quite interesting because people want to go back and they want to read, either have their prejudices confirmed or not, or just have something that will make them laugh. So.
There's also another side to your question. At NPR, most of our shows are not call-in shows, but the ones that are have been the ones most receptive to experimenting with blogging and Facebook and other tools. Our most popular call-in show I mentioned before, it's called Talk of the Nation. It's a daily show that happens from 2 to 4 p.m. each day. And during that time, they also have guests in the studio or connecting via satellite or ISDN or something. So they can only fit in so many calls from the public in any given hour, maybe 5 or 6 in a good hour. So they now have a blog that goes with it. So if there's an interesting discussion, they could be getting 70, 80, 100 comments from a variety of people talking among themselves as they're having the conversation on air. And then meanwhile, the producers of the show follow the discussion thread. So when a person says something that's particularly interesting as a discussion comment, they end up reading it on air to spur further discussion. And so they're trying to create this symbiotic relationship between a live call-in show and a discussion that's taking place in near real time on a blog. Now, the next step is, I'm hoping in the coming weeks, we're going to get them playing around with Twitter as well, so there's going to be even more immediacy because there are a lot of people who are listening who might only be able to participate if they're able to do something over their mobile phone. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how that works out once they start going in that direction.
And I think that also at play is the interplay between synchronous and asynchronous. So you talk about you want to be watching TV and doing your blog post at the same time. You can only do that if it's asynchronous. And then when you want a synchronous situation, it's usually a special event, like something that you all want to watch at the same time. In the U.S., something like the Super Bowl, one of the only times people actually watch television for a live event. And when you start talking about radio, I think there are a lot of similarities with a lot of these new live broadcasting tools because it has a very similar experience of you're all there at the same time. And there's some value in that, and then there's also some value in the asynchronous.
The Super Bowl is a really interesting example because, of course, people were using Twitter to talk about the game. But then there's this one guy, a social media consultant named Jeremiah Ouyang, who's got a fairly large following on Twitter. And he posted a tweet saying, wouldn't it be interesting if, rather than talk about the game, we talked about all the commercials that were playing in between the sequences of the game and then have everyone vote on a scale of 1 through 5, I think it was, in terms of what they thought the quality of the advertisement was. Because Super Bowl is the biggest day of the year for advertising in the U.S. It's when all the best new commercials premiere, and they literally spend millions of dollars just to get 30 seconds of airtime. And so it's always the big buzz of the day. Even if the game is really good, people still end up talking about the commercials. And so in a matter of minutes, he started getting hundreds of comments as the commercials aired. And by the time the night was done, there were something like 2,500 or 3,000 tweets that were simply 1 through 5 ratings of different commercials. And then he created a spreadsheet of all of this and figured out all the averages for votes for the different commercials, ranked them on his website, and then sent it to all the advertisers just to show them, you have no idea, but there are millions of people out there who are sitting in front of your TVs, their TVs, throwing things at the TV because they hated your commercial so much. Now some of those people have a voice, and now you have documentation on how bad your commercial flopped. And it was, in some ways, it was
real free market research.
Free market research, yeah. And it was a real eye-opening moment, I thought.
Jemima.
I just want to throw that question back at Robert and ask these great tools like Quick and these live video tools, how are we going to use those? What ideas have you got?
Oh, I'm going to say something really boring, but the thing that always worries me about these sorts of things is the business and the economics about them. I've worked for the BBC and I've worked for other commercial organisations, and The Guardian is kind of somewhere in between. And the thing that I worry about is the sustainability of a lot of these things, because in some cases there are very, very few people watching. I mean, I've done live events for the BBC. When you look at the web stats live, there's people watching, and you're in the low hundreds, and it's just not sustainable. It isn't. And when you get to a stage where digital proliferation has got to the extent where you are, you know, you've got several the resources of your journalistic staff doing, you know, tweets and copying other people's tweets and live blogging, all that sort of thing, for not a huge amount of people. I mean, it's economics and it's scale. At the moment, I don't see a huge, I hate to be negative, I don't see a huge amount of point right now. There are some things that we clearly need to experiment with, but we need to pick those really carefully. I don't think there's the money to be able to just throw resource at these sorts of things.
I think it also depends on how you do it. I think if we at NPR were to invest in a lot of high-end camera equipment and the bandwidth to do real hardcore video, it would be hard to justify it. But thanks to things as simple as webcams on Mac laptops, and free tools like Mogulus, we've been able to do video experiments that have zero cost to do them. Just a few weeks ago, colleagues of mine who have a radio program called All Songs Considered, they had invited a folk musician to come to the office and literally sit at one of their desks and play some songs. And the whole idea behind this is that there are certain folk artists and performers that perform so softly that you can't really appreciate what they're trying to do in a large concert venue. So they said, let's literally invite them into the office, sit them at our desk, and have them play some songs with maybe 10 or 15 people present. And so one day they announced they were going to do this for a particular artist, a guy named Vic Chestnut. And unfortunately, I was working from home that afternoon. And I posted on Twitter saying, I can't believe Vic Chestnut's going to be in the office. I'm going to miss it. I wish someone would set up a webcam so I could watch it from home. 5 or 10 minutes later, I got a tweet from a colleague, and it said, Andy, go to mogulus.com/allsongs. And all he did was he took the guy's laptop, which was just going to be sitting on his desk doing nothing, turned it to where the artist was going to be sitting, and then set up a free Mogulus account. And so I tweeted it, a bunch of other people tweeted it, and all of a sudden we had an audience of, it wasn't huge, but it was probably 75 or 100 people watching at one point for a live broadcast that didn't exist 10 minutes before that. And we were able to do it just completely spontaneously like that. Now, is it a good quality of audio or video? No, it's terrible. But we were recording video that day, professional video, that would probably take us a week or so to edit and put online. So it gave us a chance to invite the public to observe what we were doing in real time and anticipate what was going to come later. Mm-hmm. And so it ended up working out really well. And I think they're going to do another one in about 45 minutes. They've got another artist who's live, and I think they're going to do it again.
Yeah. And I would also add that I think both of those things are true. I think it's true that it's not proven yet. It's a new thing, but I think that it's in such an early stage that you're seeing the inklings that something is really happening here. And especially if you can do it completely for free. Before I was coming here, I was looking at some of the live blogging, and there's a channel on Mogulus called The Digital Lifestyle, and they had 7,000 people concurrently watching when I left. And they're broadcasting all of that at absolutely no cost right now, which is pretty incredible. I know the business models are still getting worked out, but you could get something pretty professional with not a lot of investment.
I was just going to say, you were talking about radio and live radio, Robert, and you could imagine a scenario where an extension of our live blogging of minute by minutes, instead of doing live blog, minute by minute, you do an alternative commentary so that you could broadcast. So, you know, we have very witty and funny sports commentators and sports reporters who could, you know, who already do an excellent podcast. Could that be translated instead of what you could have the BBC or ITV or whatever football match on and listen to the Guardian commentary? So, you know, there's all sorts of things that you think of in that sphere that could work. I mean, we're only sort of tipping our toes in the water at the moment. It's really interesting.
Yeah. And I would also add that I share office space actually with Mogulis in New York, and some of the most successful channels are radio stations and radio shows that have just set up a camera, right, because these are people who already know how to improv and be live and be entertaining when they're live, and it just adds another free element since they're already there.
We've only got time for one more question. Oh, there's two people. Okay, two questions.
Okay, very quickly. My question comes from a particular professional perspective at The Guardian Weekly. We've got a very, very highbrow, very relatively old audience. More than 90% of them have master's degrees or above. Very, very highbrow. And I'm sitting here trying to imagine if you've got a live blog for The Guardian Weekly audience, the sort of thing you'd live blog would be the... a Chatham House conference on the Middle East or something like that. And I just wondered if anyone knows of any examples, because, you know, at the moment it's kind of very much at the popular kind of level of football and sport, and perhaps politics is getting a bit closer to that. But if there's any examples of people taking this up to a highbrow, more highbrow sort of level.
I'd like to think that's what we do at NPR with some of our political live blogging and tweeting, because we have a similar audience. It's well-educated. The average NPR listener is in their mid to late 50s, so it's by no means a young audience, but online the audience is a bit younger than that, and so we're trying to figure out ways of exploring what the middle ground is. And one thing that's gotten me personally attracted to Twitter is there are a lot of people on Twitter who are news junkies and political junkies. They can't absorb enough of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And since one thing NPR has always done very well is in-depth political analysis and commentary, it was a natural place for us to go. Same thing with music. There are a lot of experiments taking place for our music programming. And but at the same time, you wouldn't see us using it most likely for sport, because it's not something we do very well or that we're known for. And so I think it doesn't matter where you fit in terms of the demographic spectrum. You can still most likely find a critical mass of people who are using these technologies that may not fit your overall demographic, but are still... there's still a critical mass there where they would appreciate having you trying to do the experiment, and they want to be there for you and help you along as well, and are very sympathetic to you trying to succeed because they want you to succeed.
And also, just to give a simple example, a lot of the live coverage that we do, initially we were much broader, and then we realized we had to really define what Ground Report is and what we're trying to deliver. A lot of the panel discussions we've done, it's a really easy extension because everyone is already there. Often there's already audio set up. And we will live broadcast these events. And, for instance, often I am contacted by reporters at the New York Times, at different publications, who say, oh, thank goodness this is there, then I can watch it. And an example is... last Tuesday we did an event on the future of media, and it was a panel that included Michael Wolff from Vanity Fair, and then reporters from New York Times, Reuters, Newsweek, the New York Post, different sources like that. And it was certainly something that I think would probably please an audience like that. And at the same time, it offers something new, which is often there's the live chat. The organizer of that particular event didn't allow the live chat, but you can do the live chat, and we'll do things like we'll have questions coming in from Sweden or from half across the country during these events, and it adds another level of participation.
John.
I've come in a time machine to this meeting from time machine from the past, and this actually is as far into the future as I've ever been. So forgive me if I haven't quite followed everything. But we in the past spend a lot of time checking things. We're very worried about facts, about something that's wrong. And the panel appears to think that everyone out there really is pretty nice, or if they're misguided, they can soon be corrected. But I sense that I spend quite a lot of time being talked to by public relations people and political parties and people who have a vested interest in getting something into the Guardian. And the reason that's true is because it's a mass circulation paper, and it's worth their time, spending time and effort to get false impressions into the paper. And so my question really is whether part of the splendid, vibrant enthusiasm and belief in the benign nature of the world is because what you're talking about is still in its infancy. And more successful you are, the closer you'll come to the rather suspicious world that I'm going to go back to shortly.
I don't think it's benign at all. I mean, there are a lot of jerks out there using these tools. There are lots of nice, interesting people you want to spend time with. The challenge is knowing when to ignore them and how to tune them out. And so I think it's, at least in my own experience, journalists at NPR and producers at NPR that have been more willing to experiment with these tools tend to be ones that have been using the internet somewhat longer or have grown up using it, and they know when to tune people out. And so with Twitter, there can be a lot of noise, and a lot of it can be very unpleasant. But there, technically, it's, you know, you can unfollow someone, and if they're causing problems, you can ignore them. If there's a chat room, you can pay attention to the people that you want to hear from. And there are ways you can reward good behavior. And so using our website or using our airtime to promote those comments from users that were most thoughtful and most civil and most productive to the conversation. And so I think there are ways where you have to learn to ignore these things, because all the users of these tools, it's natural for them to be surrounded by a lot of jerks out there, and they just know when it's time to tune them out. And so I think in some ways it's more cultural, because it's new for us as journalists how to use these tools. We think that our audience isn't smart enough to tune them out as well, whereas in many cases the audience is way ahead of us in that regard. Now, it gets a bit trickier when you're using these tools to actually collect data or facts for a story you're trying to put together. So whenever there's been an earthquake or some other type of incident, you very quickly on Twitter get multiple perspectives, many of which are not exactly correct. But often there's a grain of truth in individual perspectives, in the same way that when a group of people eyewitness a crime event, they may not have all the facts straight. They may have not put it together in their heads very well just yet, because it's still emotional and the adrenaline is running. But by adding up the different perspectives that you're able to collect, you're often able to glean some kind of truth, or able to figure out what's noise and what is worth pursuing further. And so that doesn't necessarily mean those direct quotes are ever going to make it on air, but it helps you paint the picture for what you need to be researching next and what you need to be tackling professionally next. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there you do want to tune out, because it is utterly useless. It just takes a lot of practice to get to that point.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I think it is certainly a challenge, and it is now, and it probably will become a bigger one. But I think the internet does have two things on its side, and one is the sort of obsessiveness of the community and the ability to detect authenticity.
Yes.
Because people online, they see a viral video. For instance, Hillary Clinton created a fake viral video. It was supposed to seem homemade, but it wasn't. It was professionally produced, and it had the opposite effect. It antagonized hundreds of thousands of people. So people can tell when something's been authentically created. I think the other thing is that because a lot of people active on the internet have so much content and media thrown at them all the time, they're forced to be able to filter really well, and they're forced to be able to put things in different categories, and I think they learn to detect pretty quickly when something's going on that's off. And a good example of both of these things is Wikipedia, which is the encyclopedia that anyone can edit. And an amazing opportunity for a PR person to go in and tell you know, that Coca-Cola is the best beverage on the planet. But surprisingly, there are so many different viewpoints that show up. And often if something is written like a press release, at the top it says, note, this is written like a press release. So you're sort of aware you're aware of what you're getting into.
But, I mean, John, your question is at the heart of this, isn't it? It's the heart of all of it. So it's a brilliant question. Great moment to end our fantastic session. And join me in thanking this really rather wonderful panel. Thank
you. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.